Anyway, it is 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And let's start off with our updates from the field. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign. Mike Meese is working up a sweat today. Probably everyone on the West Coast was. Temperatures were hotter than hell everywhere. As he has every day for the past week, cutting, hauling, loading, and unloading the firewood that will keep the Buffalo Field Campaign community warm throughout the upcoming Montana winter, and that's about a week or two away, I guess. Buffalo Field Campaign's campaign coordinator, who co-founded the organization more than 12 years ago, and has dedicated virtually every aspect of his life to the effort ever since, is not one to tire easily. No, no, no. I know Mike very well. But cutting the more than 60 cords of wood necessary to heat Buffalo Field Campaign's main cabin, two office cabins, and the cabins of neighboring volunteers, supporters, and community elders is a Herculean task that would exhaust anyone. While Mike has had occasional help from summer volunteers not engaged in outreach tabling in Yellowstone or at work in the office, he has been doing the lion's share of wood gathering by himself. If you know Mike, and I do, this will not surprise you, and it doesn't. His dedication to protecting the buffalo and their right to migrate and his single-minded focus on accomplishing the task at hand are unrivaled. But woodcutting is only a small part of Mike's work. In addition to all the other preparations necessary for the coming season, Mike is organizing fundraisers and planning a West Coast speaking tour, both of which are time-consuming jobs aimed at keeping the Buffalo Field Campaign healthy and strong and building grassroots support for protecting wild bison. Mike will spend the next 2 weeks gathering firewood and hauling it back to the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters, where, with your help, it will be cut into stove-length pieces and neatly stacked for winter during the Buffalo Field Campaign's annual Woodcut Week. This year's Woodcut Week will take place between September 14th and the 20th, and you are invited to join us in West Yellowstone for a day, a week, a weekend, whatever you can do. Volunteers are greatly appreciated, and you'll get room and board and the opportunity to work side by side with that famous Buffalo Field campaigner, Mike Meese, and all the other dedicated Buffalo Field campaign coordinators and volunteers in the beautiful Yellowstone ecosystem. I bet you can't wait. Can't make Woodcut Week in person, but you want to help anyway? Donate now to help cover the costs of Woodcut Week, including food and housing for volunteers, firewood permits, and fuel and maintenance for trucks and saws. Thank you very much. Here's where to send your money. Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That address again, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zipper 59758. Give generously. If you have something you want to donate other than money, go to their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They do have a wish list there. And so take a look at that. And before you send it, do call 406-646-0070 to make sure they still want it. And if you're going to go up for Woodcut Weekend, also give them a call, 406-646-0070, to get the exact directions and every other bit of information you'll need to know about Woodcut Week at the Buffalo Field Campaign. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. Let's turn to the forest update for Santa Cruz County, prepared by our indefatigable Jody Frediani. And this one's for August. Came out a little more than a week ago. Couldn't get to it last week, so here it is. Santa Cruz Bioregional Council has put together a white paper on ecologically sustainable forestry in redwood ecosystems of the Santa Cruz Mountains. In it, they explore the question, is the commercial harvest of redwoods as practiced in the Santa Cruz Mountains ecologically sustainable? Five management actions are reviewed and discussed, including connectivity, integration of streams, rivers, and wetlands, forest complexity, landscape heterogeneity, that's a hard word, and old growth reserves. The article can be found at www.scmbc.net/sustainableforestry.htm. That's scmbc.net/sustainableforestry.htm. And check it out more than once. Let's talk a little bit about a new timber harvest plan. It's the Lago Marcino Timber Harvest Plan 1-08-063 in San Mateo County. The second review on that was canceled because of the fire. Roy Webster is the registered professional forester. Mr. Webster agreed never to submit another THP to avoid being prosecuted over the St. Francis timber harvest plant at Mount Madonna, which violated a number of forest practice rules and caused environmental damage. However, Mr. Webster seems to have forgotten his promise, and CAL FIRE is not holding him to it. Oh, and did I mention CAL FIRE set the statute of limitations to expire on the district attorney's action against the LTO and landowner for that THP, so no one is getting fined for cutting too many trees in the Wilpez, that's the Watercourse Lake Protection Zone, for falling logs into the stream, potentially disrupting the downstream owners of in-stream water intakes, etc. And CAL FIRE was unwilling to go after Webster for cutting down a 72-inch redwood with 10-inch limbs, even though the plan prohibited cutting old-growth redwoods or redwoods with old-growth characteristics. You've probably heard a lot about them in the last few weeks, but Big Creek Lumber was the LTO, that's the licensed timber operator, on the ground-based operations for that plan and felled the large old tree. The tree had been marked for retention, as agreed upon with the Department of Fish and Game, but Webster told the neighbors he had a right to substitute. Does he plan to substitute trees on the Lago Marcino THP? That THP, while not large, includes something like 10 acres of old-growth redwoods, many with 60-inch trees and larger. Even though a marbled murrelet survey was conducted and none were found, the Department of Fish and Game is still concerned about the loss of any late Cyril habitat, particularly in this area where marbled murrelet habitat is found nearby. The presence of murrelets was detected less than a mile from this plant area. The Department of Fish and Game pre-harvest inspection report states the THP provides no mitigation for the loss of these late Cyril habitat elements in high-quality wildlife trees. Department of Fish and Game noted a third of the old growth was marked for harvest. Department of Fish and Game notes at this rate of harvest, only 3 trees will remain in 50 years. A number were cut during a previous harvest in the 1990s, also by Roy Webster. Department of Fish and Game also noted that some of the highest quality potential marbled murrelet nesting habitat in that region of San Mateo County. Department of Fish and Game believes the plan is not in conformance with the forest practice rules. However, Webster is arguing vociferously, and CAL FIRE seems to be backing him up. Here is the Department of Fish and Game's most significant recommendations at minimum to protect the large late Cyril forest habitat on site and to comply with the forest rules. The THP should be revised to include language stating that no trees exhibiting old growth characteristics will be harvested, no large woody debris will be harvested, and no snags would be harvested. The Department of Fish and Game recommends that late Cyril forest be retained permanently via a conservation easement. So I guess there's still time to send letters. Send them to santarosa.publiccomment@fire.ca.gov. Be sure to mention THP1-08-063-SMO. Tell them, save the old growth. It's the least we can do. And the Board of Forestry has issued a cease and desist letter to Jody Frediani on May 28th while the state was in crisis with no budget and a huge deficit. Jody received a letter from the Board of Forestry Professional Foresters Registration Division delivered to her door, via a courier who drove all the way from Sacramento in a van. Outstanding use of public funds in such a time of crisis. The letter was signed by Eric Huff, ex-Big Creek Forester, and asking me to cease and desist from advertising as a purveyor of consulting forestry services under the moniker Jody Frediani Environmental Forestry Consulting or Jody Frediani Forestry Consulting. Oops. She doesn't advertise. The letter then cited the code that says you cannot act as a forester or use the title unless you are a registered professional forester. The letter also admits that I had not done such a thing, but that the language I have chosen to describe her consulting services was close enough to deceive the general public into the belief that he's qualified to practice forestry. I don't think that's happened yet, and as for the record of for those of you who may be confused, Jody does not practice forestry. She tracks it. She works to get bad THPs made better or denied, participates in the development of regulations, and as you all know, that. The letter continued, though I can understand your desire to be associated with those who have fulfilled these rigorous requirements and may therefore be identified as a registered professional forester, you possess no such qualification. Wrong again. The letter does assure me that peaceful social activism is a right of any person in this state and the greater union. This correspondence is not intended in any way to curtail or infringe otherwise upon that right. Well, that's a good thing. However, such letters of intimidation seem to belie that statement. The letter then claimed those who wishing to make comments on a community wildfire protection plan, which he did, are obligated to do so under the color of the qualifications actually in their possession, which Jody did. There is nothing in the code that prevents me from calling myself a forestry consultant. That's what I do. I consult on, she does, that's what she does, consults on forestry issues. Not a consulting forester, but a forestry consultant. Maybe they'd prefer I call me a forestry issue consultant. Except they seem to think they have exclusive rights to the word forestry. And the Board of Forestry's letter was concurrently copied to the Deputy Attorney General, for what that's worth. On August 10th, the First Amendment Project sent a reply to Mr. Huff at the California Board of Forestry on Jody's behalf, advising him that she will not cease to identify herself as a forestry consultant. The letter goes on to say that the Board of Forestry has no authority to limit the use of the word forestry and notes that the Board of Forestry letter was an effort to punish Ms. Frediani for and discourage her from submitting public comment on behalf of her clients. Your letter thus attacks her and her clients' First Amendment rights of free speech. Ms. Frediani demands that you officially withdraw your letter to her. That letter was sent a couple of weeks ago, and she's still waiting for a retraction, of course. She's not holding her breath, other than try not to inhale any more smoke from the Lockheed fire. The First Amendment Project cites chapter and verse of a variety of court cases supporting my right to use the word forestry in my signature line. It also notes the rule Huff cited as apparently unwritten. Wow, it looks like the Board of Forestry is trying to apply underground regulation against Jody Frediani. Would that Cal Fire and the Board of Forestry would pay half as much attention to foresters who violate state regulations like Roy Webster, damage the environment and the public trust resources. And written a few days ago, this says, as of August 17th, the fire had burned more than 7,000 acres north of the town of Davenport up and through Swanton and into parts of Bonnie Doon. Blessed by the lack of strong winds, a massive response from CAL FIRE, including more than 2,000 firefighters plus 3 mornings of coastal fog, allowed them to get containment at this point on 100%. And they didn't lose any houses. There were a bunch of outbuildings that burned, but apparently no houses. Excellent work. The fire started on a remote, non-contiguous parcel belonging to Big Basin State Park. There is a road very near the ignition site, but it passes through Lockheed and only can be accessed from behind their closed gate. The cause is unknown and apparently still under investigation. Those of us in Bonnie Doon are extremely grateful the fire did not spread into their community. The majority of the lands that burned along the Big Creek Lumber, Cal Poly, Swanton Pacific Ranch, and C-Max. Jody was told that most of what burned was chaparral, chamise, and knobcone pine. Look forward to learning more about how much the overstory canopy burned in the conifer and hardwood forests. There was some, but not much. In case you missed it, Bud McCrary of Big Creek Lumber has finally admitted in print that large old-growth redwoods don't burn, but the small ones do. Maybe now the timber industry will stop pretending that logging the larger trees is good for fire protection. Well, we can wish, can't we? Look at this tree. It's 900 or 1,000 years old. It was just going like a blowtorch last night, but it should survive, he said. Even those parts of Big Creek property that were burned probably won't be lost to timber production because fire takes out the younger, spindly redwoods, McCrary noted, leaving the older ones whose bark is nearly fireproof. Most of that doesn't apply anymore because the fire is pretty much contained at this point and the smoke is dying down. Coming up starting tomorrow is the Salmon Restoration Federation 12th Annual Coho Confab, taking place at Jug Handle Farm on the Mendocino Coast. There will be a tour of habitat restoration projects in the Usal Forest. That's a very beautiful place, by the way. The Garcia Watershed, which is being restored, Ten Mile River, and Caspar Creek. Participants will learn about fish passage, large woody debris placement, forest conservation, and native plant propagation. Dana Lyons will also play at the Saturday Night Barbecue and Campfire. For more information, call the Trees Foundation. At 707-923-4377 or visit their website www.treesfoundation.org. And I think that's everything that applies. That was the forestry update for August, courtesy of Jody Frediani, forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz Group of the Ventana Chapter of the Sierra Club, and we thank Jody for her monthly forestry updates, and we hope that she can continue providing that service. Please donate to the Sierra Club to make sure that that happens. Write your check to Santa Cruz Sierra Club and write Forestry Task Force on the check. That'll help. Yes. And forests are falling to a beetle outbreak out back. Anyway, this story by Ed Stoddard and editing by Dawina Chiaku. And I believe this is for Reuters, Environment News Service. From a vantage point of an 80-foot tower rising above the trees, the Wyoming vista seems idyllic. Snow-capped peaks in the distance give way to shimmering green spruce, but this is a forest under siege. Among the green foliage of the healthy spruce are the orange-red needles of the sick and dead, victims of a beetle infestation closely related to one that has already laid waste to millions of acres of pine forest in North America. The gravity of the situation is very real, said Rolf Scar, a forestry campaigner with Greenpeace. And we've talked about this story before, but I thought I'd keep bringing it up because it keeps happening. The plague has cost billions of dollars in lost timber and land values and may thwart efforts to combat climate change. As forests are strong storing houses of carbon, the main greenhouse gas blamed for global warming. The beetle outbreak, which has taken a lesser but mounting toll on spruce trees, could make it much tougher to meet the ambitious target to reduce U.S. carbon emissions by 17% of 2005 levels by 2020 and an 83% reduction by 2050. That is laid out in the climate bill that narrowly passed the U.S. House of Representatives and waits Senate debate. Many researchers have also linked the infestation in the U.S. and Canadian West to climate change, notably a dearth of winters cold enough to kill the voracious little bug larvae. Pine beetle infestations are cyclical in nature and have been occurring for thousands of years, but what is making things worse now is the effects of global warming, said Scar. If you don't have the really cold extremes to kill off the larvae under the bark, you're going to have extreme infestation events, he said. In the Medicine Bow National Forest, scientists are getting a first-hand look at the carbon implications. The forest is home to the U.S. Forest Service's Glacier Lakes Ecosystem Experiment site, in a tower with gadgets that, among other things, examine the carbon flux of the forest. The site was established a decade ago before the spruce beetle infestation and gives scientists a unique chance to measure the changes to carbon storage wrought by the insects. We are getting readings here every half hour, said Colorado-based U.S. Forest Service scientist Mike Ryan, shouting above the wind as he pointed to an instrument that measures carbon. This gas analyzer resembles a small space capsule on the end of a horizontal metal pole. In the terminology of trees and carbon, a healthy forest is a net sink with trees storing carbon as they grow. When they die and rot, they emit carbon back into the atmosphere, so a dead or dying forest becomes a net source of greenhouse gas, meaning it emits more carbon dioxide than it stores, Ryan said. The net carbon storage in this patch of woods is about half of what it was 3 or 4 years ago. In another 3 or 4 years, he believes the forest will become a net source of carbon. This scenario is being replayed across the West. In Colorado, aerial surveys show that from 1996 to 2008, Colorado lost 2.5 million acres of pine forest to the beetle outbreak. Wyoming, 677,000 acres. South Dakota, 354,000 acres. Over the same period of time, the spruce beetle, which has also ravaged forests as far north as Alaska, took out 374,000 acres of spruce trees in Colorado, and 340,000 acres in Wyoming. That cumulative total of over 6 million acres is an area larger than Israel or South Africa's Kruger National Park. Further north in Canada, the pine beetle has attacked trees over an area of 39 million acres in British Columbia alone since the 1990s. The sheer scale of the damage can be seen northwest of Denver in Colorado's Yampa Valley. Vast tracts of formerly evergreen forest now have huge splashes of orange running through them. According to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, a third of the United States land area is covered in forest, but is only expanding at the rate of about 0.1% per year. Under cap-and-trade provisions in the U.S. climate bill, additional forest growth may be encouraged through a market mechanism that will allow reforestation efforts by landowners and other groups to be counted as carbon offsets. Such projects could generate cash through carbon credits paid by polluters who want to exceed their own emission caps. A forest can recover, but that can take decades. Most forests will recover the carbon they lose, but if in the next 50 to 100 years it is important that we may not have that much time. It's setting back carbon storage efforts, said Ryan. Forest growth in the United States currently sucks up about 12% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. That's a big number. To get another 10%, you have to convert a third of U.S. agricultural land to forest, said Ryan. The outbreak has other consequences. It is creating huge fire hazards as it leaves mountains of combustible wood in its wake. In a worrying trend, it has also spread from lodgepole pine to ponderosa pine. And there are expenses for landowners as well. On his ranch in northern Colorado, mountain realtor Bill McClellan points out to a dying tree and says, "A week ago, that tree was green. I've lost another one." In May, he had cut 476 pines on his property and then had them ground into wood chips, an expensive operation. That is one of the few ways to contain the outbreak. He reckons that an infestation will generally shave about 20% off the value of a private woodlot or ranch. Past beetle outbreaks have been stopped by very cold winters, but recent winters in the West have not been cold enough. Another factor scientists contribute to the outbreak is past forest clearance and fires that saw large areas cleared. Often when this happens, the forest that regrows in its place will have huge patches of trees the same age, and this makes them susceptible to a collective attack when they mature at the same time into older trees that the bugs favor. The beetles may collectively wreak havoc by nesting and feeding in the trees, but they look harmless enough as individuals, not least because they are so tiny. In Medicine Bow, Ryan points to a few writhing in a glass jar that have been trapped on the trunk of a spruce tree. Until we get a big cold spell, they are going to go on until they have nothing left to eat, he said. Well, there's a lot of forest out there to eat. So, pray for cold. Kills the bugs. Let's move to some biological diversity news. Warming threatened bird gets cold shoulder from the feds. In a blow to sound seabird science and a denial of the Center for Biological Diversity's petition, this Tuesday the Obama administration refused to grant protections to California's imperiled ashy storm petrel. The diminutive smoke gray coastal bird is endangered by climate change, ocean acidification, pollution development, and other threats. And a recent study has found that it's taken a nosedive in numbers over the past two decades. A single oil spill in the right place could decimate a large percentage of the bird's global population. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar is continuing a Bush era approach of denying protections to species based on an incomplete and selective interpretation of the science, said Shea Wolf, who, as a seabird biologist with the center, should know. The decision reads like a laundry list of excuses to avoid acting to protect the ashy storm petrel rather than a solid evaluation of the science. And on a wing and a prayer, the condor may make a northwestern comeback. Northern California's Yurok tribe is using modern science in the first steps to restore one of the tribe's most ancient icons, the California condor, to its historic northwest range. While the condor now has a scantily reintroduced population in parts of Arizona, Southern California, and Utah, no condors have yet been reintroduced to the Pacific Coast region, where it once soared over Lewis and Clark as they made their way west. The biggest obstacle to reintroduction is lead poisoning, which condors can contract after dining on carcasses shot by lead bullets, which the Yurok tribe is now testing for in local turkey vultures. The condor is sacred to the Yurok, one tribal member said. It can soar the highest, so we figured it was the one to get our prayers to heaven when we were asking for the world to be in balance. Ironically, the condor has been one of the creatures suffering the most from human-caused imbalance. So, besides needing prayers itself, it must have as much protection from lead poisoning as it can get. The Center for Biological Diversity has been working to protect the condor from lead poisoning since 2004, when they first launched their Get Out the Lead campaign to require the use of non-lead ammunition in the condor range. Thanks to the Biological Diversity Action, in 2007 a law was passed to do just that in California. We're now launching a nationwide campaign to address all lead poisoning of all American wildlife. And Bring the Sting, an entomologist inspires happiness case study. Ever been stung by an insect and savored the experience? Entomologist and Center for Biological Diversity member Justin Schmidt certainly has, on six continents with more than 150 types of stingers. A veritable sting connoisseur, Schmidt mentally immerses himself in every encounter with the wrong end of a venomous bee, wasp, or ant he's studied. He's even created the Justin O. Schmidt Pain Index, which rates each sting's level of pain from 1, a tiny spark, to 4, absolutely debilitating. Once evaluating a hornet sting like a discerning wine taster, Schmidt described it as rich, hearty, and slightly crunchy, similar to getting your hand mashed in a revolving door. The sting of a bullet ant in Brazil was less delightful but definitely interesting, leaving him still quivering and screaming from peristaltic waves of pain 12 hours later. The New York Times ran an article last week on Schmidt, calling his work a case study in finding happiness, the sense of well-being achieved entirely caught up in the moment. And of course, always appreciating the bullet ant sting, Schmidt recognizes its crucial role in the world, excruciating, pain-inducing stinger and all. If you'd like more information, contact the Center for Biological Diversity. You can get that information from their website at www.biologicaldiversity.com. .org. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a podcast of this or any previous Earth First Update, here's how you do it. Go to www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and select Earth First Radio, and you'll have a variety of Earth First updates to contemplate. That's right. We want to thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and providing those shows for our listening audience. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Earth First Update. Thank you for listening.